Yeah, I spoke with UConn political science professor Evan Perkoski about a new study that he did with a colleague of his, Michael Posnansky, from the University of Pittsburgh, that was published in the Journal of Global Security Studies. It's the first time that a study has looked at whether nations or hacking groups take credit for their cyber attacks. And the study is called Rethinking Secrecy in Cyberspace, the Politics of Voluntary Attribution.
Hmm.
Professor Perkoski is a specialist in political violence and terrorism. He's been studying that for a long time, and Professor Posnansky researches clandestine covert interventions among countries and why they might try to hide their actions. So there's going to be a discussion about state actors, which are countries, and non-state actors, which are terrorist groups or hackers. And the idea for doing this began when they were both postdoctoral fellows at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
We were there, and we were tossing around a few ideas about the differences between how states and non-state actors behave in cyberspace, where you see non-state actors always claiming their attacks, always branding websites that they take down, taking hold of Twitter accounts and putting out their message. And on the other hand, you see states doing the exact opposite strategy, where states are really quiet and clandestine and covert. They don't want people to know about their cyber operations. And so our question was, why is this happening? Why are you seeing such different strategies?
The claim of credit can have consequences. How did you look at it from that perspective? Because throughout the paper, you lay out different arguments, but come to some conclusions on that.
So there are lots of ways that organizations, individuals, and states can claim credit. So it's not just a dichotomy, right? It's not just that you claim it or you don't. But we find that there's a whole gradation of claiming that actors can pursue. From total denial, we saw that throughout lots of clandestine interventions in the Cold War, where the United States would say, we neither confirm nor deny that we were involved in this intervention. And then you can move up slightly to only claiming to the person that you hacked. So maybe when the U.S. responded to the Russian meddling in the 2016 election, they might have responded and just let Russia know it was them, but not the broader public. And then you can move all the way up to how non-state actors often do it, which is very public, very clear credit claiming. But you can't often observe it, so it's a really difficult thing to study. That when states do it, it's often quiet, and we have no idea if it's actually happening.
Well, let's also discuss the two different types of cyber operations that you work on. One you describe as pretty much cyber crime, and the other cyber blackmail, and they're two distinct ways of doing this, and with two different agendas.
So in this paper, we kind of bracket both cyber crime and cyber blackmail because we think they're inherently different forms or types of cyber operations with different goals in mind. So typically with cyber crime, you're doing it for personal motivation, personal gain, financial gain usually. Because of that, we don't think it'll follow the same logic as states operating against other states in cyberspace. Sometimes you see states operating in cyberspace for financial gain, such as North Korea. North Korea has a really difficult time getting foreign currency because of all the embargoes and trade restrictions on them. So they might use hacking operations to get some of that currency. But oftentimes when it is bad individuals trying to steal Bitcoin or whatever, that's a different logic, so we kind of bracket that. And the second one we also bracket is cyber blackmail, which is really what happened with North Korea, or what we think is North Korea, hacking Sony for releasing the movie about Kim Jong-un. They hacked into Sony servers, stole some sensitive information, and said, we want you to do X or else we'll release this information. It was a form of pretty basic blackmail.
Now, you also point out that the taking of credit for these activities is largely depending on what the so-called intruder wants to accomplish. Now, you touched on that a little bit, but if you could go a little bit detail as to what the differences might be based on the objective.
So we break this down into objectives that both states and non-state actors might have. And by non-state actors, I mean terrorist groups, cyber hacking units like Anonymous, like Syrian Electronic Jihad, like some of these organizations associated with the Russian state that are a little bit more independent. For states, we argue that they're likely to take credit for their cyber operations when it favors or helps further their goals. And one of their goals might be to coerce an opponent. So if your goal is to coerce or change the behavior of an adversary, it might make sense to let them know you're doing it. You're going to keep attacking them if they fail to change their behavior in the future. For non-state actors, there's a slightly different strategic logic at work, where they are in a very different position from states. They're weaker, they don't have as many followers, as much financial resources as states. So for them, claiming credit can be a way to build up a reputation, to gain new followers, to get that message out there. In that sense, the logic of claiming by non-state actors is pretty similar to why terrorists take credit for their attacks. That when the Islamic State conducts an attack in Paris, or even another group, the Islamic State might try to take credit for it because it builds their international prestige, maybe gets recruits more excited, and gets new followers from Western Europe to join their organization.
You point out that this is likely to be the very first study that looks at the constraints that are involved with making these decisions. Why would that be the case that this hasn't been looked at before?
It's interesting. So we're kind of the first movers on this because cybersecurity is just a really new topic. It's very much reminiscent of studies of nuclear weapons during the early phases of the Cold War back in the early 1950s and even to the 1960s, when we didn't know how to use these weapons, how they'd affect international strategy, how they'd make influence whether states can coerce an opponent and get Russia to do what the U.S. wants it to do. So in that sense, it's a very early or very young field. So that's one reason why no one has worked on this before. And the second reason is that lots of people just assume that you want to remain anonymous in cyberspace. And for a long time in this literature, people argued about the attribution problem. And the attribution problem is this idea that if you can't attribute cyber attacks, well, then you can't use them to do certain things that states often want to do. You can't use them to influence another state, because if you don't know who's doing it and it doesn't have a return address, how does the other state know who to respond to or who to update their beliefs about? And so when Mike and I were working on this paper, we kind of took a step back and said, you know what, the attribution problem doesn't always exist. That it exists mostly for states who don't take credit for their attacks. But for non-state actors, you often do see them claim their operations. And if you claim it, then an attribution problem doesn't exist. So it kind of was a product of faulty assumptions and just the early stages of this field, why no one had kind of looked at this question in depth.
What direction do you see the inquiry going for others? Because you've now opened the door for others to pick up where you left off, which is the normal process in research, that you can raise questions that you might not be able to answer yourself, but others will then decide to do. And then secondly, what's the result or the impact going to be now that people are starting to be aware of how this thing happened?
I think one of the most important takeaways from this paper is that applying this distinction between clandestine and covert operations to cyberspace has really opened the door for lots of new inquiry. That not all cyber operations are inherently anonymous, and that actors can claim credit for them. And when you can claim credit, that opens the door to using cyber tools as almost traditional instruments of state power. For a long time, we thought they're always anonymous and you can't do certain things with them. But if you take that away, then we can start using them like traditional weapons, like cruise missiles and like bombing attacks and other kinetic operations against foreign states. So how they're going to be used in the future is a huge question that we don't totally know about yet. Another important question that we need to answer is, how do groups and non-state actor groups in cyberspace operate? What keeps them together, and how do they form? We know a lot about how terrorists and insurgent groups come together and what sustains them, but we don't really have a theory of any of this stuff for hacking organizations and whether they follow the same paradigms or not. So how do you defeat a militant organization or this sort of hacking collective like Anonymous when they're all spread out throughout the world? They operate in some states that don't have extradition treaties with the United States. And they might even operate in some states that give them de facto immunity. So we know, for instance, that Russian hackers get not necessarily support from the government, but they allow them to operate freely because they're operating within their own interest. So that raises a lot of questions about how to understand these groups.